Welcome to KABU, Cynthia Lou Coleman.
Thank you, Jan.
Well, Dr. Coleman is Professor Emerita of Communications at Portland State University, a researcher in the fields of scientific discourse, environmental policies, and their impacts on North American Indigenous peoples, and author of Environmental Clashes on Native American Lands. She is also an enrolled member of the Osage Nation. Well, thank you for joining me on the Old Mole Variety Hour this morning to talk about your recent, very important book. But before taking up that work, can you say more about yourself and how you took up this topic of science and Indigenous communities?
Thank you again for having me on. I think I would be disrespectful if I didn't introduce myself to your audience in our language, which we call Wajaje. So I would say to you, Hawei, Ie to Akipshe Kombre, Mixita Wita, Niagonska, Wajaje, Jaje Wita, Cynthia Lou Coleman. What I said is, if I hope it's okay if I say a few words in Osage. My name is Cynthia Lou Coleman. My indigenous name is Ishtatoto, and I'm from Pasoli, which is our word for gray horse. So
Thank
that tells you a little bit of background. Obviously, you can tell that I'm Osage and learning the language, not very quickly, I'm afraid. And so what drew me to this sort of research is that I have a background in science communication and a background in environmental health and risk. And that's really what's driven my communication career for years and years. And I really could never not study Native issues. And by that, I don't mean the anthropological view of studying Native American people, but rather, how is it that they use their lens on the world to figure out how to live? And so, what attracted me to that were the environmental struggles, or their scientific struggles, or their risk struggles, or their medical struggles that Native people have come up against, that they've confronted, where, in my view, it's not a symmetrical relationship, meaning that typically it's because something is being forced on them, or their opinions have been taken for granted.
Well, your book provides a fascinating and deep analysis of the Kennewick Man case study in science, racism, and Indigenous knowledge. And I'd love to have you talk about this case of the 9,000-year-old skeleton that was found in the Columbia River area of Washington near Kennewick, Washington. And maybe talk about what was at stake in a very bitter and sustained conflict over the claims to these skeletal remains.
It went on a long, long time, more than 20 years, and this body was discovered by accident in 1995 in the Columbia River. And what happened was there were a couple of lads who were crossing the river. Somebody stepped on what they thought was a rock. It turned out to be a human skull. And they sort of debated, what do we do about this? And ended up taking it to the city of Kennewick, where, bunches of people got together and said, boy, we should kind of figure out what this skull is. And wouldn't you know it, there is a freelance anthropologist who lived nearby who had helped them in other cases. And his name is James Chatters. He came in. And he said, this skull doesn't look like a pioneer. It looks a bit older than that. So the story goes that they returned to the Columbia River. They extracted what is almost a complete skeleton and kept it in Kennewick and waited for a piece of the bone to be studied and carbon dated so they could figure out how old it was. And originally they figured the skeleton was anywhere between 7 and 10,000 years old. So that's an interesting story all in itself, right? So this discovery in 1995. Concurrently, the native tribes were not at least from the first go, they weren't involved in any of this decision making. And what folks may not know is that there was a law signed, a federal law that was signed in 1990 that said, if you find human remains, or if you find funereal objects, or anything that looks like it could be Native American that's located on land that's not private, you have to notify the local tribes, or and at least get in touch with people that can help you broker information with the tribes. And that wasn't done, according to folks like Armand Menthon, who became a spokesperson for the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla. So it began sort of on bad footing. I'm not saying that would predict the outcome, but the native folks said, this is probably one of our ancestors if it's that old. And there's a law that says it needs to be returned, not just protected, but repatriated to the tribes.
That's the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act.
That's right. And so it's actually been around. Now we look back and say for a long time, I think from the Indigenous point of view, it wasn't enacted early enough. 1990 is pretty late in terms of Native American, how would you say, provenance over there, over our own bodies and our own artifacts.
That act itself came out of tremendous pain and deep history of violations of Aboriginal ancestors.
I don't want to get too distracted from your question, but that's really part of what the book is about too, is sort of the legacy of, not just Indigenous people, but folks that were considered primitive in some regard. It's called race science by people that think that it has the study of human individuals has been led a lot by belief systems as opposed to, sort of what we would consider scientific information. And it's a bit wonky in the sense that in the 1800s, a scientific method rose that they called phrenology. And what phrenology means is the study of the brain or the study of the mind. And basically, it divided humans, Homo sapiens, into between 5 and 8 different categories. And if I said them to you out loud, they would be quite disrespectful to the people that they refer to. And so, if it's okay with you, I can tell you what how the phrenologists framed that, and that is that the most powerful, important, beautiful, smartest, elegant human people are the Caucasians, and they're right at the top, right? And then below that, they stack people that they call Orientals, that they call Ethiopians, referring to anybody from Africa. They also have a group of people that would be considered in a different sort of Eastern category, and then the Native Americans, who they simply called Americans,
This is part of your larger argument about racial hierarchies and racial ideologies driving practices of science that are considered empirical and or sometimes contrasted with the spiritual ethos of Native practices. There is this a whole set of mythologies and ideological interests guiding the history of science, including how this came to bear on approaches to skeletal remains.
Exactly. And I don't think it would be a surprise if I told you that a lot of these assumptions had to do with also scientists understanding that Native Americans, but other folks as well, could not change, right? So look at what has happened, they would say. We've educated them, we've shown them railroads, we've shown them how to do things properly, and they just won't learn. And so it's a misinterpretation of an inability to be civilized, and that's what a lot of settlers considered Native people to be, not just uncivilized, but not civilizable. But what that does is it enables you to say, well, if we can't change them, we're just going to have to kill them off, or reduce their bloodline so much that they're going to be real Americans. Take the Indian out of the person.
Right. And that has a very bitter, violent history attached to it.
So the scientific method, I think, is very, very clear in terms of, saying you don't want to have bias, you don't have an, sort of interpretation from your belief systems. And you know what? We're human beings. We all are subject to that. So, science is not as clean as we pretend, n nor is it something that should prevail over every single issue to say this is really the ultimate way of looking at this. So, if I were speaking, and I cannot speak for all Indigenous people, I don't mean to do that, but to speak from a view that is more open-minded to Indigenous points of view, it would be, well, how do they know what they know? And it's not just empirical, because it would be silly to say Native people aren't scientific. Of course we are. Have you seen, the camas that grows in Oregon? That was so important to the Native people. Does it have a sacred component? Of course it does. But guess what? It's not separate from the scientific. It's all seen within one picture. So if a Native person were to say, these are sacred, that's not a part. It's not distinguished from science. And a lot of tribes don't have a word for science, but they don't have a word for, the white god either. So they have words for relationships that we have with our surroundings.
And that there's a material grounding to that spirituality. It's not only about a remote father god, but very much grounded in observations and survival in the world around us, and rich practices that have shifted over time, and observations that inform much of our understanding now of the climate crisis, if we're to pay attention. But
Exactly.
with the Kennewick man, you're saying part of how your interest was over time, how this was framed in public discourse between science and superstition or spirituality. Can you continue with the story and say how it was resolved on either grounds? What was the denouement of this story? And was it one you felt was satisfying?
That's a really good question because we didn't know for so long. I've been studying this since 1995. It really took a course that I would not have predicted. And that is that there was a crew of Danish scientists that also got permission to take a look at a piece of bone. And it took a long time for them to try to figure out whether there was a relationship with the local tribal people. So the Confederated Tribe of the Cowlitz, or the Colville, excuse me, agreed to give them saliva so that they could look at DNA. But it took a long time. And in the final analysis, what they did was they published a piece in Nature that said, guess what? Kennewick Man is a relative to Indigenous people in California, sorry, in Oregon and Washington. What was interesting to me in reading that story is they, in reading their publication, was that they also said that the way that the anthropologists went through talking about whether the skull was Native American or a pioneer was phrenological at best, meaning weren't making scientific judgments. They were making judgments based on their beliefs about what a skull should look like.
So there was an irreducible ambiguity around the appropriate test for Kennewick Man. And you're saying part of what was important at that point for the tribes in this region was the approach based on respect and a deep attentiveness to the different ways people were approaching Kennewick Man. It's a process that was based on respect, which was lacking from the start with
And
the
there are cases where Native people have worked with scientists all over the place, right? In terms of just think of all the work that CRTFIC, the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Council, does with their own biologists who are also Native people. Native people are not anti-science, right? So that's really a mistake that we get from the coverage of that. And then just to answer sort of your question about, well, then what happened? Well, after this, sort of this important publication explaining that they found this connection with DNA, Patty Murray, who's a legislator in Washington, asked President Obama to return the skeletal remains to the Native tribes. It took, I think, a year and a half for that to happen, but it did. And so the Native people did not invite the press. They did not invite people who had a vested interest, and they buried respectfully the ancient one that they call him, and we don't know where it is. And sometimes you just don't know, and that's okay.
And maybe that's a commentary itself on the hubris of Western science that rejects ambiguity and uncertainty. And that's where many of these horrible decisions with long-term consequences supported by science that are part of industries and practices that have been so destructive to Indigenous peoples come out of that kind of short-sighted idea and the hubris of orienting science toward conquering and controlling nature. So there are many, many other interesting insights, cautionary tales in your book. It's a great read. I love the book, even though it's clearly written by an academic. It's accessible, and the
Yeah.
Kennewick man's story, the way you unpack it and its manifold lessons, I think are so important.
Thank you. Yeah. And I hope this doesn't sound terribly like an advertising pitch, but the way that the publisher has set it up, you can actually, buy a chapter if you want. You don't have to buy the whole book. And
That's interesting that it's available in sections or chapters. Say the title again and where listeners can get it.
sure. The name of it is Environmental Clashes on Native American Land. The publisher is Palgrave, and that's www.palgrave, palgrave.com. And also I've ordered it for any library that would, order it for me. So
I very much appreciate you promoting Worlds Beyond Amazon that has devoured so much
exactly.
of our culture, including literature. Well, thank you so much, Cynthia Luke Coleman, for being with us today on the Old Mole Variety Hour, and I hope you can join us again.
Thank you, Jan, Dr. Hackin. It's been my pleasure. I appreciate it.
Can you hear our voices? We are one.